Welcome to ASA Central Line, the official podcast series of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, edited by Dr. Adam Stryker.
Welcome back to Central Line. I'm Dr. Adam Stryker, your host and editor, and today we're going to learn about a few items highlighted in the 40A issue of SEE, or Summaries of Emerging Evidence. We do this every once in a while to highlight some of the important studies or items that are included in SEE and hopefully make it interesting for our listeners. And today we have Dr. Elisa Brzezinski, who is one of the SEE editors, and she's here to educate us on some fascinating recent studies. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Brzezinski.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, Dr. Brzezinski, before we jump into the studies and a couple of the items you want to highlight with the SEE issue, if you don't mind, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your work with SEE and how you arrived in this position.
Sure. I am a pediatric anesthesiologist. I work at the University of California at San Diego and at Rady Children's Hospital. I came back to this program many years ago, mostly with an interest in resident education. And as part of that resident education, I really enjoyed keeping up on the literature and working with the residents to pass on the new literature. I had a colleague who was writing for SEE at the time, and he had let me know how much he enjoyed it. And so I joined as a question writer. And after a number of years, then I was asked to join the editorial board, which is my role now. It's a great process. It definitely keeps me up with all the literature, and I can use all that literature to talk with my residents that I work with on a daily basis.
Excellent. Well, we always try to highlight a little bit of what the SEE is currently highlighting themselves. It's such a great program, and hopefully a lot of our listeners are taking advantage of what it has to offer. Let's dive in and talk a little bit about a couple of the studies that you want to highlight on today's show. One of the studies involves prophylactic methyl ergonovine in laboring women who are obviously at higher risk for postpartum hemorrhage and require an intrapartum C-section. I believe it's comparing the use of that with straight oxytocin, but before I get too far afield, why don't you go ahead and highlight what this study's about and some of the important facets of it?
Sure. So for our anesthesia colleagues in the obstetric space, postpartum hemorrhage is a major cause of morbidity and mortality, both in the United States and worldwide. And in fact, postpartum hemorrhage rates have been increasing. They are significant for us because they contribute to about 11% of maternal deaths in the United States, many of which are preventable. On top of this, we know that the number one cause of postpartum hemorrhage is uterine atony, and many of our patients that are undergoing a C-section after having labored for a period of time are at significant risk for that uterine atony. So there's always a search for any methods that might help us reduce that risk of postpartum hemorrhage from uterine atony. And to date, the standard of care has been utilizing oxytocin following delivery of the newborn. However, even with that oxytocin, especially on patients who are already receiving oxytocin for labor augmentation, it may not be successful. And thus, finding a method that could negate or prevent that uterine atony would be beneficial for our OB colleagues.
Let's just talk a little bit about how the study was conducted. Any insights into the methodology?
Sure. There was about 160 women at a single center, and they had all been laboring, and a decision was made to proceed with a cesarean section. So in the study, women who had a known history of any type of hypertension were excluded from the study, given that methergine can exacerbate hypertension. Additionally, any patients that had any known placental anomalies were excluded. And so then the women were randomized to receive either the standard of care, which, as I mentioned, would be an oxytocin infusion following delivery of the baby, or they were in the trial group, which, in addition to the oxytocin, they would receive 0.2 milligrams of intramuscular methergine, regardless of what the uterine tone was. The placebo group also got an injection, but it was only an IM injection of normal saline. So the actual anesthesiologist was delivering something in IM form regardless. After this happened, then uterine tone was assessed every 4 minutes, and additional uterotonics were administered at the discretion of the obstetric team and obstetric anesthesiologist. They were allowed to utilize whatever next uterotonics they felt was necessary and typically would follow standard ACOG guidelines. The study's primary outcome was to determine if there was any change in the administration of additional uterotonics in the group that received this prophylactic IM methergen dose.
And what did the researchers learn?
They actually found that the group that received IM methergen in addition to standard of care had less administration of additional uterotonics. They also looked at secondary outcomes, including the rate of postpartum hemorrhage, which in a C-section would be anything over 1 liter of blood loss, the rate of blood transfusions, as well as what the quantitative blood loss was. In those groups, the outcomes were improved in the group that had received the IM methergen. So overall, the percentage of women who received uterotonics achieved both primary and secondary outcomes more frequently. When they looked at the numbers needed to treat, it was about 3 patients needed to be treated to achieve this benefit. So a relatively low number needed to treat. And overall, they had no additional or found no difference in the rates of hypertension between the two groups. So despite the prophylactic administration of IM methergen, there was no patients that had additional hypertension in that group.
So based on that, should labor and delivery units adopt the strategy?
It's interesting. Based on the study, it would suggest that there's a significant advantage to potentially utilizing the prophylactic dosing of IM methergen. I don't think it's quite yet adopted across labor and delivery units. In speaking with our own labor and delivery unit, they actually have not adopted it despite the study coming out. But this is one additional piece of literature that would support early, if not prophylactic, administration of IM methergen.
Well, and talk a little bit about the SEE program in general and the studies highlighted or the emerging evidence highlighted. As anesthesiologists, do we look at it as just in general pieces to add to the entire picture, or are we supposed to weigh the evidence more than the other platforms? Or how do you, as heavily involved in this program, how do you advise anesthesiologists to look at the studies in general?
I think it's an opportunity to consider the new and emerging literature that's out there. However, I would always encourage us to view the literature along with our colleagues that we're working with. So with something that's so multidisciplinary as obstetric anesthesia, it is great for us to bring our own literature to our obstetric colleagues and to discuss and create policies. But it's hard to do that in isolation. So I think the teamwork approach has significant advantages.
Well, it's perfect, because I think it'll be a good segue into discussing the next study, which is a little different. And we'll delve into that here in just a minute. But before we do, let's go ahead and take a short patient safety break. Please stay with me.
Hi, this is Dr. Jeff Green with the ASA Patient Safety Editorial Board. Communication gaps during patient handoffs in the perioperative setting increase the risk of patient harm. While electronic tools can improve communication and patient safety during handoffs, low-tech strategies can go a long way toward ensuring continuity of care and accurate information exchange. These include standardized checklists and templates, as well as patient safety communication techniques such as read-back, repeat-back, and other closed-loop approaches. Formalized, structured templates ensure that key information is communicated to all personnel involved in care transitions, such as for OR to PACU or OR to ICU transfers. For shift changes in the OR, a less formal and more portable 3x5 note card with key safety information can be handed to the clinician assuming care of the patient. With both approaches, face-to-face communication between providers is essential for a safe handoff. There is no one-size-fits-all strategy to safe handoffs, but adopting a standardized process may improve patient outcomes.
For more patient safety content, visit asahq.org/patient-safety.
Well, we're back. And the study I had alluded to right before the break involves pediatric airways. Let's go ahead and learn a little bit about this study. Dr. Brzezinski, talk to us a little bit about what this study involves, maybe cover what it was trying to study and also the nuances with the methodology and how that might ultimately affect the conclusions.
Sure. So difficult airways are our thing in anesthesia. It is our domain to control and something that we as anesthesiologists are frequently concerned about and plan accordingly for. However, the approach to pediatric difficult airways may differ from our approach to adult difficult airways. For many of my adult colleagues, their approach to a known difficult airway would be to provide topical anesthesia and then to go ahead and intubate the patient with minimal, if any, sedation on board. In pediatrics, the incidence of an unrecognized difficult airway is less common compared to our adult counterparts. However, we also recognize that in our children, it is less likely that they are going to be able to participate with us in the same manner that an adult might. It can be very challenging to topicalize a pediatric airway and to get buy-in from a pediatric patient to do that with minimal or no sedation on board. Additionally, when there is difficulty with securing the airway, some untoward side effects can happen in our children, and they can be more problematic compared to our adult patients. So our pediatric patients are at risk for not only hypoxemia when an airway can't be secured, but that hypoxemia can result in bradycardia and additional downstream sequelae that can be problematic. So because of the developmental level, the willingness to accept, we often actually enter into difficult airway management with a different plan for our pediatric patients compared to our adult patients. Pediatric patients often will actually receive a general anesthetic with spontaneous ventilation, or there's some data that suggests that perhaps we can do a general anesthetic and ultimately actually use paralysis in some of our difficult airway patients. In this study, it was recognized that there are a handful of anesthesiologists that still utilize sedation for their pediatric difficult airways. But we don't have as much information as to which technique is better. We know that the practice out there is probably more common for anesthesiologists to be doing a general with spontaneous ventilation management of a difficult airway. But is that truly better than a sedated airway management for a pediatric difficult airway? So this study aimed to answer that question, and they utilized a different study methodology. Essentially, they are a registry. They have 34 different international hospitals which were contributing data, and all that data was collected prospectively. With that data, they were then able to look at the differences between patients that received their airway management with sedation versus general anesthetic.
So a couple of things. The Pediatric Difficult Intubation Registry, it's a topic we're going to actually cover in an upcoming episode. But as far as the study specifically, I just want to tease out a little bit. You mentioned that it was difficult to ascertain what kind of techniques the practitioners were using. But as far as the study goes, what specifically was the determining factor between sedation and general anesthesia when classifying these into one of those two groups?
That information was self-reported by each individual site. So that was at the discretion of the individual site to note. However, it was noted that there was differences amongst the sedation that was utilized. And some of the sedation things that we would consider to be topicalization or local anesthetic were also used in some of the general anesthesia patients. So it was totally up to each individual site to determine what they were utilizing and what level of sedation versus general anesthesia was on board.
Okay. Well, let's talk now a little bit about the methodology on this study. There's some differences you already mentioned, but let's just delve into a little bit of the details on that, if you don't mind.
Sure. The study itself, as I mentioned, was comparing the use of general anesthesia versus sedation for airway management in patients with known or suspected difficult airways, as well as airways that were difficult upon laryngoscopy. So they specifically were examining the first attempt success rates for intubation in children less than 18 years of age. And overall, they had about 839 patients, which were included. In order to be defined as a difficult airway, the child either had to have a suspected difficult airway, which could be defined by what the anesthesiologist suspected would be difficulty with direct laryngoscopy due to impossibilities of anatomy. So they noted something like severely limited mouth opening, which they would expect all the anesthesiologists would rate that as something that they could not intubate the child with or would have significant difficulty. Additionally, the child could have a history of documented difficulty with direct laryngoscopy within the preceding 6 months or had predictors of difficulty, such as anatomical features like severe mandibular hypoplasia. Finally, they could also have had difficulty with laryngoscopy that was noted previously, which was noted as Cormac-Lehane score of 3 or greater. So if a child fell into that difficult airway, then they were eligible to participate. And of all those patients that had those, they pulled out both the patients that received general anesthesia versus a quote-unquote sedation for their anesthetic. They separated them out, and there was a great difference between the group in the numbers. So there were 75 patients who received sedation and 1,764 patients who received a general anesthetic. So knowing that it may be more difficult to match the patients because they wanted to do propensity matching, along 21 different variables, they went ahead and took the group with the sedation, and they took the patients that they anticipated would be the hardest to match, and they allowed this algorithm or this matching process to find a match with the general anesthetics. And they did this multiple times, and each sedation case could be matched with up to 15 general anesthesia cases. Not every sedation case received a match from the general anesthesia cases, and there may not have been a total of 15 that were available to match from the general anesthesia cases. So they could be anywhere from 0 matches up to 15 matches. They also went ahead and grouped the patients by age cohort with the knowledge that it would be more likely that our older patients would be able to tolerate a sedated intubation, and thus they suspected that it would be more likely that our older patients would be represented with the sedation cases as opposed to our younger patients.
Okay, so let's just elaborate just for a sec on why no general anesthesia patients were matched to more than one sedation patient. Why is that?
The authors didn't want to reutilize any of the general anesthesia patients, so they wanted to include as many patients as possible, but they wanted to ensure that every sedation patient that could be matched would be matched. And thus, since there were just so many more general anesthesia cases, they went through the process and matched up to 15, but did not reuse any of the general anesthesia cases for multiple sedation patients.
Okay, so then let's talk about the outcomes. What were the outcomes they were looking at?
Sure. So primary outcome was success of the first intubation attempt. They wanted to see how likely it was with either anesthesia technique that the intubation could be done successfully. Secondarily, they wanted to look at factors such as the number of intubation attempts, if more than one was needed, the type of airway device that was used on the first intubation attempt, the initial anesthetic technique versus the anesthetic technique that was required for successful intubation, which would lead to potential conversions to another anesthetic technique. And then finally, they wanted to look at any complications, whether they be severe or non-severe. So they defined severe complications as things that would be particularly problematic, things like cardiac arrest, severe airway trauma, an unrecognized esophageal intubation, pneumothorax aspiration, even death. The non-severe complications included desaturations, minor airway trauma, esophageal intubation that was recognized and remedied immediately, laryngospasm, bronchospasm, some bleeding, or even emesis during or after the procedure.
Okay, well, now let's get to what the takeaways were.
Within the study, the rate of first attempt success for intubation didn't differ between the patients in the two groups. So the patients that received sedation and those that received general anesthesia had similar first attempt success rates at intubation. There are some things to acknowledge with this. Specifically, I think I mentioned it previously, but it was more likely that teenagers received sedation versus the younger children, which may be a factor for us. But overall, it argues that it is less important the technique that is chosen for a difficult airway management, and rather that the anesthesiologist should use the technique that they are most comfortable with, depending on the resources that they have around, as well as the patient factors that are present. And that will ultimately make one more successful. Additionally, I do want to point out a large number of patients, a little over a quarter of the patients who were in the sedation group ultimately required general anesthesia for their successful intubation. So having a backup plan available, even if you utilize one technique, should be considered, and a backup plan should be determined before embarking in your chosen anesthetic approach.
Well, we both practice pediatric anesthesia. Generally, what do you take away from a study like this as a pediatric practitioner?
Yes. So I think as a pediatric anesthesiologist, I'm curious your opinion too. We all have our techniques and our ways that we prefer to do things, and many of us are successful with it. So it's really much less about protocolizing one specific technique for these difficult airways, but rather ensuring that you use the technique that you are most comfortable with. So if you don't feel most comfortable doing a spontaneously ventilating general anesthetic for a difficult airway in a teenager, and you would feel more comfortable and have more experience with utilizing sedation in that patient population, you should utilize that technique as your go-to technique, rather than deviating from your technique just because someone else tells you that it might be better.
Yeah, certainly. I agree. But I also think for the study like this, I kind of think it highlights just how complicated the pediatric population really is. Dividing up the groups was paramount to teasing out some differences, but I think that that's borne out in our practice. I think we would all agree that a difficult airway in a teenager is so different than a neonate. And obviously, they both potentially fall into the, quote, pediatric population. To me, one of the biggest things is just that it highlights how difficult it is to truly tease out real evidence on how best to manage the airways. And then you couple that with the fact that, what was it, 20-some percent? You said over a quarter of the study population actually that were in the sedation category had to be bumped to general. And whatever that means, if we don't know the specific techniques, I think it also, as you alluded to, highlights how we need to be flexible with these patients, especially the younger ones, and that a sedation, quote, versus an anesthetic, quote, may not matter, that kind of binary thought process, as much as it is, you know, the continuum and the constant reassessment and alteration of whatever is necessary to accomplish the airway management safely.
I couldn't agree more. You need to know what your resources are around you, including and what can help you for a difficult airway is especially important. So I certainly would not jump into a known difficult neonatal airway without having potentially my ENT colleagues around or other backup plans available for me.
Absolutely. you know, some of the evidence out there shows the significant increase in potential difficulty with neonatal airways. And so, and that's, again, borne out even my practice. I mean, some of the more recent airway issues I've had have been in some neonates. And so it can be pretty dicey. And having those colleagues, having the support systems around, it's so important. And especially as you determine how you're going to go about airway management in these kids.
Definitely.
Okay, well, let's bring it all back now. Overall, with SEE again, what do you and the SEE team, what would you all like to see individuals understand about the program?
Yeah, so I think overall, SEE is a group of individuals who are really dedicated to giving back to the anesthesia community at large. And through this process, we really attempt to thoroughly review the current literature and bring it into a more digestible form for all of our anesthesia community. So it's probably impractical that everyone's going to be reading each and every one of these articles in their entirety. And thus, SEE can be a wonderful source of continuing medical education, keeping up on the literature for any practice, whether you be in academics or in private practice, et cetera. Additionally, because we are so passionate about it, there is a lot of review that goes into each individual write-up. Approximately 8 different levels of review occur to create this easily digestible product for everyone. And so we're really trying to do everything we can to bring something that's beneficial back to the anesthesia community. And we hope that it's helpful for everyone. Finally, we are always looking for anyone who might be interested in joining. You may be someone like myself who just hears about the product. Perhaps you haven't even been utilizing it, but we are always looking for people who want to join us. Initially, you start out as a writer and then can jump onto the editorial board down the line once you get involved in the process.
Wonderful. Well, it's an excellent program. And, you know, by highlighting it every once in a while here on this podcast, we're hoping that our members can take advantage of it. It's excellent work by all of you. So if you're listening and you haven't checked it out yet, please check out the SEE program. The website address is asahq.org/SEE. And Dr. Brzezinski, thanks so much for joining us today, highlighting a couple items on the current issue. And thank you for all your hard work on the SEE program as well.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the time here.
Great. And to our listeners, in one of our upcoming episodes, we'll be covering pediatric airway registry in detail. That'll be a few episodes from now. So please tune in again next time and take care.
You can't read everything, so SEE does it for you. Learn what the specialty is learning on your own time. SEE is available now with insights from journals from around the world. Try a sample question at asahq.org/SEE. Subscribe to Central Line today wherever you get your podcasts, or visit asahq.org/podcasts for more.